The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Welcome to What About Wealth? Making it, investing it, protecting it, leaving a legacy with your hosts, Rich Bloomfield and Rick Durfee. In today's economy, preserving wealth has become more important than ever, especially when it comes to our future generations. Now, here is Rich Bloomfield and Rick Durfee.
Good morning, everyone. This is Rich Bloomfield. I'm the CPA.
Good morning. Good morning. This is Rick Durfee. I'm the lawyer.
And we do this show, What About Wealth? And we like working together. We like working together with clients because it gives them the best outcome. And that's what we've done for the last 15 years or so. And it makes everyone happier and actually makes the work that we do make sense for people and actually gives them tax savings down the road like they were planning. So that's why we work together, Rick.
That's why. And we're glad to be on this show where we get to share some of those ideas and some of the practical consequences of that experience with our listeners.
You can reach us at anytime at www.whataboutwealth.com. We also have presence on YouTube. And you can call us at 480-324-8000. And we're also on the voiceamerica.com business channel, of course. So anyway, Rick, today we're excited about today's topic, which is we're calling the future of planning. And the reason we're doing that is because we've gone through and looked at kind of where we are now that we've gone through most of a year after the fiscal cliff and the tax law that was finally put into effect at the beginning of January 2013 called the ATRA, A-T-R-A. And we kind of want to review where we are with the planning and so that can give our listeners a little bit of a focus on what things have changed and what things they should be concerned about, what things they don't have to be concerned about on a going forward basis. So we'll be doing that when we get into the show, but there's a lot of interesting news out there that we want to talk about that affects your wealth. So, Rick?
You know, one of the first things is the farm bill, as it's called, which is mired in the political turmoil of the day, has a huge impact on food stamps. It's one of the key components of it, where people are given these coupons with which they can obtain groceries. And in the last 10 years, the number of people on food stamps has more than doubled. It's now clocking in at about 47 million. I saw another thing that said had a different number, but I think 47 million is the one that's being thrown around now. And for the first time ever, the number of Americans receiving food stamps has continued to increase even when the economy is growing. Typically, the number of food stamp recipients goes up and down as the economy goes up and down, but now it's just going up and continuing to go up in spite of the fact that the economy is growing. And you can make your own conclusions on what policies or incentives the politicians may have for doing that, but
or whether it's just a changing mindset in America where we're okay with being taken care of by the government. and we've always been self-sufficient. But I really wonder if somehow that very American trait is being replaced, and we have more people that are just okay with being taken care of, being a nanny state. So,
well, you know,
it's the give a man a fish or teach him to fish that's become almost cliche, but there are those two very opposing views as to how we ought to implement policies and programs to assist people in need, and the give them fishes and make them dependent upon stealing the fish from the fishermen has become kind of the norm. It's an interesting thing. Which then there's another little quirky thing in the news that government workers are 38% more likely to be absent from work for personal reasons such as illness or other personal things going on. 38% more likely than the private sector, where if you don't show up, you get fired. Governments miss 50% more of their usual work hours as a result of absences than private sector workers. And, of course, this is according to the government Bureau of Labor Statistics. So if you work for the government, you have little risk of getting fired. Obviously, competency is not an issue. If it were, we would see very different outcomes coming out of the White House and other places. And neither is customer service a particularly big concern. So where competency in customer service is not a concern, let's turn our health care over to those people. Yes, which is where they don't have to be competent and they don't have to care about you, which is another little curious thing. You can keep your plan, we were promised, but so far about approximately 1.5 million people have already lost their health care coverage as a result of Obamacare, and this is according to the National Center for Public Policy Research. And the politicians are shocked. Oh, outraged. How could this be? How could this be? It's not supposed to work that way, they all say with feigned outrage. And, of course, now the House is considering a keep-your-own health care plan to address the issue, which is like putting a Band-Aid on a decapitation. It's not going to make any difference. But
well, you see, the problem is that they're estimating groups that follow this are estimating that up to 14 to 16 million people will actually lose their health care coverage, being forced onto the exchanges. And they're almost all of those people are people that have personal plans that they pay for themselves. And they're typically the most healthy and ones that utilize it the least. And those are the ones that that Obamacare is depending upon to make the numbers work, because they're the ones that will be funding all the sick people and the old people. So so they knew about this 3 years ago, but
sure.
Over and over and over and over again, Obama has gotten up and said, you can keep your doctor, period. You can keep your health care plan, period. So interesting, the extent of the lying that has gone on. So
it's another steal from the fishermen so that we can give fish to the poor and make them dependent. And, you know, we've quoted this before. When the people want a free lunch, they elect thieves. And when they want the impossible, they elect liars. And since free lunches are impossible, thieves and liars in office. Anyway, it's kind of interesting, the fight over this, the farm bill, is going to have some other impact. The news is kind of centered on the cuts to the $80 billion food stamp program that we mentioned a minute ago. But some of the other consequences are when they cut out or reduce some of the subsidies to farmers, it's anticipated that this can push the prices of milk. It's now they're estimating it's going to price of milk is going to go up to $8 a gallon, and it's just simple market driven economics. You increase the cost of production. Supply and demand as it functions, then the cost is going to go up. And now that's something that I think people go to the grocery store and buy milk pretty often. I know I do. I still have teenagers in my house that drink this stuff like it's going out of style. And $8 a gallon is going to affect a lot of people.
Right. And our last bit of news is that Senator Rand Paul from Kentucky has introduced legislation calling for a constitutional amendment to require term limits in Congress and to require that any law passed by Congress has to also apply to Congress. This, of course, is in response to, among other things, the Obamacare law that does not apply to Congress, nor does it apply to the Supreme Court, who decided that this was a constitutional law. And so interesting that the people that gave us the law and now don't even have to live by it. So I don't know about the rest of you, but that sort of irks me. And I think, according to the latest surveys, at least 60% of Americans want to replace all Congress, all people in Congress, including their own Congress people. So maybe it's a good time to do this if we'll speak up and actually decide we're going to take back our country.
Yeah, that would be an interesting idea. Take back the country. Wow. We're there to the quote of the week, which kind of relates to all this stuff, actually. And, you know, we were kind of talking offline before we got on the program about how the government's own accountants are pointing out that the healthcare costs under Obamacare are going to bankrupt the government, as if it's not already bankrupt. And you have to ask the question, the politicians know this is the case. They're not stupid. They're actually rather clever. That's how they got elected. So if they know that it's going to be bankrupt the country, what's going on and why would they do this? And there's lots of people that have pretty compelling answers to that question. But our quote of the week this week is from The Economist magazine. So it's an editorial title to an article, but it's just wonderful. I think it's just nails the situation we're looking at right now. And here it is. Quote, "The big threat to Obamacare is not Republican intransigence, but the White House's own incompetence." Close quote. They go on. And I encourage our listeners to go pull this article up. This is The Economist, a very well-respected magazine that looks at economic issues worldwide, actually. In fact, you'll see articles pop up in The Economist, and a week later they'll show up on the talk show programs and on the news media. But it tells a handsome man tells television viewers to pick up their phones and shop. The phone number is, and he gives you the number, and he says, "And I want to repeat the phone number," and he tells us again. And who is this person advocating viewers to pick up the phone and shop? Is it a salesman hucking microwaves or used cars? No, it is none other than the President of the United States, Barack Obama, urging Americans everywhere to rush to their telephones to buy health insurance. And why is he urging them to use the telephone or to shop by mail or in person? Because the website for which he paid hundreds of millions of dollars does not work.
Almost a billion.
Oh, it's almost a billion. Yeah, the website doesn't work. It's just staggering. So other websites, you know, that have huge numbers of viewers. In fact, this is told all the time that Drudge Report is hosted by a guy that can't even program his way out of a paper bag. He'll say this about himself. And he has huge, huge readership. He programmed it himself. And nearly $1 billion spent on the government software, which is the cornerstone of the most significant legislative accomplishment of the current administration, and it doesn't work. And you have to ask yourself, and we want to let these people appoint,
take care of our healthcare.
Yeah, take care of our healthcare and appoint their cleverest and most capable individuals to serve on death panels to decide if we're going to live or die, if we're qualified for medical care. And of course, it takes 6 months to get the decision out of them.
By that time you're dead anyway.
So it's amazing.
So Rick, give back stories. We have you have some of those today.
You know, I just want to mention one thing. A lot of people don't know this goes on, but in spite of all the negative press that has been focused on the Boy Scout movement and its struggle with trying to figure out how to address the different moral attitudes that people have, it's still in Boy Scouting a requirement that the young men and women, specifically the young men who are in the scouting program, that they give service and that they look for opportunities to serve. And frankly, at every single rank advancement, there is some level of service required. And when a young man wants to earn the rank of Eagle Scout, which is the highest rank that a person can earn in scouting, at least in America. In other countries, they have different awards. They call it something else. But in America, in the U.S., it's called the Eagle Scout, is the highest award. And it takes a considerable amount of time, a considerable amount of energy. But one of the things that the young man has to do is an Eagle Scout service project, an Eagle project. And the young man has to plan it, has to benefit either a nonprofit or some sector of society that is need-based. And the young man has to then demonstrate leadership. So it means organizing other people to come to work and put together whatever it is they're doing for the project. And typically, some of these Eagle projects, a moderate, really relatively light and easy project will result in 100 hours of service hours of people coming together. So that's 50 people working together for 2 hours or 25 people working together for 4 hours. It's a pretty significant commitment. And many times they'll be two or three times that for an Eagle project. And we see them helping, medical kits for non-governmental organizations working overseas in refugee camps or in developing countries that are having struggles I know in my local community here there's a woman's shelter that has a shelter for abused women and children that has received a number of service projects, and these are almost nameless, faceless individuals in our communities that go out and give huge amounts of time and energy and resources. They rally friends and family members and church members and school friends and people from the community to come together on these projects. And I think they're sometimes unsung heroes of our community, and I just wanted to kind of acknowledge that today on our program. So that's our give back story for the day.
Great. Well, I know we have a couple of minutes until we go to break here, Rick. So we might want to jump into a little bit of the development of our topic for the day. And as I said at the beginning of the show, we wanted to talk about what's happening in the planning world, meaning specifically that we're going to be talking about wealth transfer taxes and how they affect the planning for transferring wealth from generation to generation, which is where a lot of our work focuses. So, let me just kind of give an overview of this, and then we'll go to break. But the law that was passed at the end of, well, the beginning of 2013, supposed to be 2012, changed the outlook and made permanent, and you have to put permanent in quotes there, but made permanent some things that had been temporary for a number of years. And so in some ways, people thought, well, this helps because at least we have some permanence. We kind of know what we are up against when we're trying to plan and help people to transfer wealth from themselves to future generations without incurring, without having the government take a bunch of it. So anyway, that's what we're going to be talking about. And we will go to break right now. And once we get back, we'll continue talking about that.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
Live well and leave a legacy. Durfee Law Group offers dynasty estate planning and asset protection services so you can do just that. We focus on helping our clients gain maximum protection and privacy by providing the right tools and innovative strategies to sustain both immediate and long-term success. Call us today to set up a complimentary consultation. Call 480-324-8000. That's 480-324-8000. Or visit our website at www.durfeelawgroup.com. That's D-U-R-F-E-E lawgroup.com. We'll help you turn the gift of wealth into a blessing for your heirs rather than a curse.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
You are tuned in to What About Wealth with Rich Bloomfield and Rick Durfee. If you have a question or comment about our program, please send an email to info@whataboutwealth.com. That's info@whataboutwealth.com. Now back to Rick and Rich.
Welcome back, everyone. This is Rich Bloomfield, and I'm the certified public accountant.
And this is Rick Durfee. I'm the lawyer.
And this is What About Wealth? And as I said before the break, our topic this hour is the future of planning, and specifically planning related to estate taxes. And so we just wanted to focus on kind of some specific areas that that we think are important and or that have may have significant impact on the way that you should go about planning either for clients or for yourself moving forward. So the first one that we want to talk about is portability, and that's been with us for a while now since this law has been in effect. But we want to talk about what is it and how does it work, and then you know how does it work in community versus non-community property states, and what do we still have to do to make it work. So I'm going to have Rick talk about some of the specifics there, but in general, I just want to point out, because I've been through this with a few clients now, is that if you live in a state or if you did not do planning, you did not set up a revocable trust prior to your spouse's death, then before this law was put in place, you didn't have the option of preserving the lifetime exclusion of your spouse. In other words, if they died, you hadn't done a trust, then the benefit of their lifetime exclusion, whether that was $1 million or whether it's $5 million, was gone. And but under portability, if you file an estate tax return, even if one is not required otherwise, which is kind of the rub for how to get portability, but if you file that return, make the proper election, then you can preserve that lifetime exclusion. So, Rick, I know there's a lot of technical things involved in portability, but just that's the overview. And do you want to jump in with some?
What it's doing actually is extending to everyone a particular feature of community property states that used to only be available in community property states, and this is the feature. In community property states, a husband and wife can transfer property between them at any time, in any way they want to. Now, obviously, we can do that on a federal level, and there's no transfer tax from that. But what happens, or what used to happen, is that in the event of death, state law didn't allow the living spouse to give property to the dead spouse because they're dead. And now, under this portability, it makes it so that, well, you can. So if within a married couple, the spouse, one spouse has property and the other spouse does not, and the spouse without property dies, the spouse with property can allocate some of that property to the estate of the dead one under the dead spouse's lifetime exclusion and cause that property then to pass to the heirs under the exclusion of the dead spouse and by so doing avoid paying a transfer tax. And again, that's something we could do in community property states all along, and now we can do it everywhere. One of the planning consequences of the lack of portability before is that in a great many states you would see people setting up husbands and wives where they would each have their own separate trust, and each trust would be separately funded. And that was because you had to do that if you wanted to take advantage of the exclusion amount for both spouses. And now you don't have to do that prior to death. You can do it after death, and which makes it, frankly, simpler to plan because you can have a single trust. And you can simply allocate the trust to a survivor's trust and for the surviving spouse, and then to what's called a bypass trust. Or that actually, lawyers use all kinds of different names for these. But the trust that's going to – the credit shelter trust that's going to use the lifetime exclusion amount of the first spouse to die. So there are some interesting consequences with this cost basis and step up in cost basis that we ought to look at. A subtle consequence of this that a lot of people don't recognize until it hits them in the face is this cost basis issue. If a person owns property that has appreciated in value, we get the idea that there's a certain cost to that property, and then its current value, and the difference between the cost and the value is gain, and that gain is taxable. We call it capital gain. And so if you sell that appreciated asset, you trigger a tax. That's a taxable event, and you're going to pay capital gains tax on it. Well, when a person owns appreciated property with gain like that and they die, there is a step up in that cost basis to the fair market value as of the date of death, which means that then that property can be sold and there's no capital gains tax. Well, this portability and the use of a credit shelter or a bypass trust has a huge impact on that, as does community property versus non-community property states. And this is kind of technical, but it's also interesting in my opinion. In a community property state, the property is deemed to be owned by the marital community, And when this a spouse dies, the marital community dies. And so there is a step up in basis on all of the property that was jointly owned by the husband and wife. So you get a step up in basis on everything. In non-community property states, historically, and we see this a lot, you only get a step up in basis on property owned by the dead spouse. So if it's a joint account, you would only get a step up in basis on half of the property, and then you get a step up in basis on whatever the dead one owned, which is another reason why people would put property in these separate trusts. Well, now this portability obviously plays into this. So if you have property that you allocate, you get the step up in basis on it when the first spouse dies, you allocate it to this bypass trust, you got a step up in basis. Now it's in the bypass trust. It was allocated towards the exclusion of the first spouse to die. So you got one step up in basis. Now on the second death, when the surviving spouse dies, whatever is in that bypass trust or the B trust, the credit shelter trust, does not get another step up in basis. You got one and you get only one. And so if it has appreciated, you're going to still pay a capital gains tax if you sell or transfer that appreciated property. But property that remains in the estate of the surviving spouse, what's sometimes called the A trust or the spousal trust or the marital trust. People, again, use lots of different words. I just call it an A trust. But it's the trust for the surviving spouse. That property gets another step up in basis. And it's now between community and non-community property states, it's more similar than it used to be. It used to be – the difference used to be bigger. Now the differences are smaller. They're more similar. In a community property state, you're going to get a step up in basis on the whole dang thing. In a separate property state, it depends. If it's an A trust, you're going to get a step up in basis on the whole thing. Actually, bottom line is if it's included in the estate of that surviving spouse, you're going to get a step up in basis. There are some nuances to that, but that's the simplest way to describe it.
So in planning for that, what are the things that play into it, Rick, as far as is it the size of the estate or what causes you to plan one way or another so that you get a step up on the whole thing?
Well, the size of the estate goes into it. The nature of assets held by the married couple goes into it. A big significant planning issue is, well, what do you do with a smaller estate? Say the estate is only $2 million instead of $5 or $10 million. So you would be okay. You would not trigger a transfer tax if you failed to use the exclusion of the first spouse to die. Well, a lot of trusts, or even wills for that matter, testamentary trusts or living trusts, both, sometimes have compulsory funding language, which forces the surviving spouse to fund that credit shelter trust on the first death. And in a small estate of a $2 million estate, you would be forced to push over $1 million into that credit shelter trust, and now you don't get a second step up in basis on it, and so you're going to end up paying more capital gains tax because you were compelled to fund that. So the smarter planners, the more aware planners, instead of making that funding that credit shelter trust compulsory, will give the surviving spouse the option not to fund it if the estate is below the estate tax exclusion. So they can, instead of pushing $1 million over into the credit shelter trust, can leave it all in the survivor's trust or for the surviving spouse and then get a second step up in basis. In larger estates, so say it's a $10 million or more estate, there's a trade-off, and typically the surviving spouse is going to have the power to elect what assets go where, and we're going to look at the nature of the assets. So if you have income-producing assets versus appreciating assets, typically the surviving spouse is going to want to retain the income-producing assets because the surviving spouse is going to want the income. But we will then want to put the appreciating assets into the credit shelter trust so that that appreciation is not subject to an estate tax. But the trade-off is you avoid estate taxes at the second death with what went into the bypass trust or the credit shelter trust, but you're going to end up paying a capital gains tax. So sometimes there's some planning, some trade-off. And sometimes we say, well, we think that the estate is going to – so another strategy, let's look at the middle-sized estate. Say it's a $7 million estate. It might be a good strategy to put $5 million of income-producing assets in the bypass trust, in the credit shelter trust, and leave $2 million of appreciating assets over for the surviving spouse on the theory that $2 million is going to appreciate, it's going to grow to $5 million, and then you'll get a second step up in basis. So it's an issue that has to be addressed knowledgeably and effectively to manage the tax consequences.
Because the surviving spouse in your example can still use the income from the credit shelter trust. They just can't use the corpus. So, so that makes a lot of sense.
All this, I just want to make a passing comment. All this points to differences in state laws from state to state, how portability works, how the bypass trust works, how the step up in basis works. It's going to be different from state to state. And another thing, the number now, I'm not sure exactly, it's about 20, some odd, 26, 27 states have abolished estate taxes, but the others have raised them. So whether you have a state estate tax is significant. Where you live can have a huge impact on whether or not you're going to pay an estate tax. And many states have taken the view that since the feds have raised their limit to $5 million, we're going to still tax them at $1 million. So the state rules can play a huge issue on whether you're going to have estate taxes or not.
Right. I was looking at the state of Washington this last week, and their estate tax is 19%. But I mean, you get a credit for that. It tends to be, kind of comes down to maybe 10% once you take a credit for it on the federal. But still, that makes estate taxes in that state 50% plus, and it's the same in other states as well. So I have to be very careful about that.
Talking about federal, because we're going to talk about what the politicians are saying they want to do. And one of the things that has been spoken in the past that the politicians want to do is eliminate that credit on the federal estate tax return for local state estate taxes. They want to get rid of that because that obviously reduces federal revenues, which would put the federal and the state governments kind of in a tax competition. Where if you live in one of those states, if they eliminate that credit, you're going to get a double zinger. You're going to pay taxes both federally and locally, and it's going to be a bigger burden than it was before.
Right.
Seeing.
Moving on here, the other thing that I wanted to point out is talking about discounts. Now, discounts have been used forever, as we know, Rick, and they're used mainly in situations where we have a lot of assets that we're trying to move out of the estate, usually by gifting prior to death. And and I've just gone through a filing season here where we did a number of gift tax returns, and in several of those situations we were doing significant discounting because the value of the assets that we were gifting were in excess of the 10 and a quarter million that we could pass by using the spouse's combined exclusion amounts. And so the Obama administration interestingly, is abandoned a proposal that had appeared in all four prior annual budgets. So when they proposed the budget this year, which they typically get around to a few months late, but they actually got it done, those prior proposals would have further limited the discounts, and it seems that that has been dropped, and so there isn't quite as much focus on getting rid of the discounts. That doesn't say that Congress can bring it back up and do it anyway, but at least from an administration standpoint, which is good news for us, because there's just a lot of situations where by using discounts, which you typically get discounts for lack of marketability and lack of control, and those discounts can be fairly sizable. So something that if you had full control and could sell it was worth $10 million might, after discounting, be worth $6 million. And which then allows you to gift it and move it out of the estate without incurring a tax. So anyway, that's the discount world right now. And we need to talk about the limited duration of GST tax exemptions, et cetera. And we'll do that right after we come back from this break.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
Live well and leave a legacy. Durfee Law Group offers dynasty estate planning and asset protection services so you can do just that. We focus on helping our clients gain maximum protection and privacy by providing the right tools and innovative strategies to sustain both immediate and long-term success. Call us today to set up a complimentary consultation. Call 480-324-8000. That's 480-324-8000. Or visit our website at www.durfeelawgroup.com. That's D-U-R-F-E-E lawgroup.com. We'll help you turn the gift of wealth into a blessing for your heirs rather than a curse.
Voice America Business Network. The bottom line in business.
You are tuned in to What About Wealth with Rich Bloomfield and Rick Durfee. If you have a question or comment about our program, please send an email to info@whataboutwealth.com. That's info@whataboutwealth.com. Now back to Rick and Rich.
Welcome back. This is Rick Durfee. I'm the lawyer.
And this is Rich Bloomfield, and I'm the CPA.
And this is What About Wealth. And for our show today, we've been talking about the future of planning, and we have been specifically looking at what the politicians are telling us they want and where they see the law going. And we're trying to address that and plan for it so that as we move forward, we can be taking advantage of what the law gives us and not get caught unawares. And the next thing we're going to look at here is a limitation on the duration of this GST tax-exempt status. And this is kind of a fun thing that takes a little bit of technical explanation. When politicians started taxing the transfer of wealth from one generation to the next, clever planners said, well, they're going to tax it when we give it to the kids, and they're going to tax it when the kids give it to the grandkids. So let's just go ahead and skip the kids and give it right to the grandkids. Well, that move was regarded as a loophole. Oh, a loophole that those dirty, rotten rich people are using to not pay taxes. And so they come up with this generation skip tax. So if you make a gift that skips a generation, we're going to tax that too. And this has been an area, frankly, that is complicated, that a lot of estate planners it muddles their head. And part of the reason for that has been that the GST exclusion and the lifetime exclusions for lots of the time in the past decade have not been the same. They've been different numbers, and so to calculate it is kind of complicated. Well, one of the things that's happened is that those are now unified, the GST exclusion amount and the gift exclusion amount are it's the same amount, which is kind of cool. It makes planning a little easier. Well, clever people figured out that if you use this GST exclusion, then the assets that utilize that exclusion are exempt from transfer taxes indefinitely over multiple generations. And so states starting with either Delaware or South Dakota, I can't remember who, there was an old rule called the rule against perpetuities that we borrowed from England for no discernible reason that makes it so that property cannot remain in a trust forever. It has to come out of the trust at some point. And states started abolishing that rule against perpetuity. And again, it's somewhere in the mid-20s now of states that in one way or another allow a trust to last forever. And this meant that people could put property in this GST using the GST exclusion that makes it exempt from transfer taxes in perpetuity, which makes it possible, you know, $1 million over four generations, if you don't pay that estate tax, will grow to over $100 million on very conservative assumptions of growth. Whereas with the estate taxes, it's only going to grow to like $12 million. So this is a huge, huge benefit. Well, obviously the politicians don't want people to do this. They want to compel the property back into the taxable estate, out of the trust. And so in the last three budgets, the Obama administration has proposed a provision that would limit this ability to do this in these dynasty trusts and would require the trust to be included in the taxable estates on the 90th anniversary of the creation of the trust, which is a kind of a federal imposition of this rule against perpetuities. And this would have the effect of kicking dynasty planning in the teeth. It wouldn't make it obsolete because there's other benefits besides the tax consequences of dynasty planning, but it would certainly have a big impact on the tax treatment of dynasty planning over multiple generations.
But yeah, and it would obviously would still be beneficial because it does give you 90 years. But
yeah.
But then it all has to come out and then you get whacked. So yeah, that's in there. And that's why I encourage, our clients, because in that same proposal, Rick, it's clear that they would grandfather the ones that were already in place prior to, that law being passed. So,
hoo-ah. Yeah, so do it now.
So in other words, I just think, and this is the next topic here that I wanted to focus on, is the even in the most recent budget submission for 2014, the administration indicated a continuing support for a return to the rules in this area as they existed back in 2009, which is namely a gift tax exclusion of $1 million. So during your life, only pass $1 million. Estate tax exclusion amount and GST exemption amount of $3.5 million, which is we're at five and a quarter right now per person, and then with a top gift estate and GST tax rate of 45% versus the 40 that we have now. So you can see that this changes in this area are not dead. They might be being overshadowed at the moment by, you know, Obamacare and other problems in the administration. But when you got a country that has as many fiscal issues as we do, and there's this big gaping, what some people consider a loophole, for those who are wealthy to pass on their wealth without getting it taxed, then it's likely we're going to see more action in this area. And so getting your planning done now probably makes a ton of sense, because there's also agreement in all camps, it seems, for grandfathering what has been done prior to passing the law. So we continue to encourage folks with significant assets to take advantage of this.
You know, I think that if this politicians could do with the estate tax exemption amount, the same thing that they've done with Obamacare, and exempt themselves so that these rules did not apply to the Senate and the House, we would see this happen in a heartbeat. Because curiously, this is bizarre to me, that flat broke individuals can be elected to the Senate. They have no money to their name. They have this $200,000 a year job. They fly back and forth across the country all the time. And after a couple of decades, they're worth tens of millions of dollars. It's just astonishing how that happens. And so they have a personal stake in this issue. And if they could figure out a way again to exempt themselves from the law that applies to everyone else, I think we'd see that the rates go back down to a million in a heartbeat.
Right. Because that would raise revenue, which they badly need. Next topic is the effect of outright gifts of appreciated securities. So, Rick, jump into that. Tell us about that.
Yeah, this is kind of a fun thing. I love charitable giving, and we do a lot of that kind of planning. But one of the benefits of the tax system, as it's presently structured, is the ability to deduct the value of long-term capital gain assets given to charity without being taxed on the appreciated interest. So in other words, you can make a gift of the appreciated asset and it's not a taxable event, and you get to deduct the value of the gift. So if a donor contributes some appreciated property, say a portfolio asset that has a basis of only $20,000, but it's grown to $100,000, that donor gets to take a tax deduction of $100,000. And there's some limitations on that. Specifically, you're limited to a certain percentage of your adjusted gross income. But the charity gets the gift of $100,000. They're happy. The donor gets the deduction of $100,000. They're happy. And when the charity sells the highly appreciated asset, obviously it's a charity, so it's tax exempt, and there's no capital gains tax on the sale of that appreciated asset. So when donors, if people tithe, for example, and I've actually had a number of clients do this, land developers that have purchased a huge tract of land and they're building houses and commercial buildings on it, and they want to tithe to their church. But now this land that used to be not worth very much because they went out and bought desert land that was in the outlying areas far away from the municipal, and now they've built this big, huge development. Now this land is worth a whole bunch, so they can give some of that land to their church, or they can give some to the local community for municipal buildings, and they get to take the tax deduction for that huge appreciation and not trigger the capital gain. So this is a cool thing. This is still in place, but I should add that the politicians are, of course, targeting it. They want to shut down this loophole like other loopholes if they can.
All right. And what else would we expect? That's just the nature of the world today. So find everything that anybody who worked hard and made money has, and try to find a way to redistribute it. That seems to be the mantra of the current administration.
I want to point out that in making such gifts, one of the trends we've seen is a trend away from private foundations and an increased use of donor-advised funds. And part of the reason for that is because of the limitations on the deductibility of gifts to private foundations. There's fewer restrictions on gifts to donor-advised funds. So that's a little aside there on some charitable planning. And I guess the final issue on charitable planning that we're seeing right now is this lifetime charitable transfer to the IRA, which was temporary and has now been made permanent. Which is the $100,000 gift. You have to be 70 and a half, and you can only do it once, but you can – oh, no, I'm sorry. I guess you could do it every year. You can do $100,000 per year directly from your IRA to a public charity other than a donor advised fund. So you can't do it to a donor advised fund, but you can do it to a public charity, and that's kind of cool, and we see a lot of people do that. Positive social benefit.
And so for those of you out there, or those of you who have clients who have these huge IRAs or 401ks, I guess, which could be transferred to an IRA, this is something that often makes sense because, as we've discussed on prior programs, moving qualified funds out of the taxable estate is very difficult to do. So it's best to try to spend those down during life. And this is a great way to do that for those who have a charitable intent, because if they are going to be paying a tithe or a contribution to an organization anyway, taking advantage of this $100,000 a year, and siphoning it out of the IRA or the qualified assets makes a ton of sense.
You know, kind of in summary for today's program, we hear the politicians today, in fact, saying settled law. And whichever side has whatever their law is at the moment, they want to claim that that's settled law and we can't change it. But the fact is, there's no such thing as settled law. When the politicians are at play, the laws are going to change. The probability of the laws changing is 100%. The probability that we'll like the change when it happens is something less than 100%. So when we plan, we have to plan on the laws we have on the one hand, but we also have to anticipate that change is going to happen. And an effective plan is going to have tools that address the possibility and the likelihood of change, and will then enable future individuals who are participating in or running a plan to adjust and make in-flight course corrections to respond to the changes so that we're not punished and damaged by that. So heads up, look out, change is coming. Change is always going to be coming. Make sure that your plan is adequate to the changes. And that's, I guess, the takeaway, the to-do for today's show.
Great. We appreciate all of you who listen, and please contact us anytime at 480-324-8000. We'd love to sit down and talk to you, and we'll do that free of charge. So please call us, contact us, and we'll be back here again next week at the same time, same place for What About Wealth?
For listening to What About Wealth with hosts Rich Bloomfield and Rick Durfee. Please join us again for another edition next Tuesday morning at 10 a.m. Eastern Time, 7 a.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Business Channel. Until then, have a profitable week.